You're back with Annie on 3CR Breakfast, and we're going to move straight along to a great little session that I went to at the Marxist Conference last weekend. It was called Unlivable Cities, the Politics of Urban Development, and it was given by Steph Price. It was just priceless, I'll have to say. So let's have a listen.
So I'm going to start at a place called the Corkman. For most of its life, the Corkman was actually known as the Carlton Inn. It was built in 1854, and people say it was probably the oldest building in Carlton. The Corkman was not very charming. That was partly the nature of buildings, pubs in particular, built in that era. They were sort of characterised by their plainness, their exterior plainness. But also, it hadn't survived the 70s and 80s well. It's sort of in, almost its entire outside had been painted with Mission Brown, who anyone familiar with the, or which remembers from the 70s was somebody's brilliant idea that Mission Brown really encapsulated everything about heritage. Does not, it's horrific. It was all over the outside. And some of its windows, this is probably from the 80s, some of its windows had been removed and replaced with glass bricks, also hideous. Neither did the pub have any particularly worthwhile social function. So it was located directly across the road from the Melbourne Uni Law School, and it was mostly used as a watering hole for Melbourne Uni Law students. But in 2016, when its owners, developers who'd bought it a few years earlier, illegally razed it, leaving just piles of bricks and clouds of asbestos in the air, it seemed that actually all of Melbourne was wounded. The Corkman wasn't beautiful, as I say, and it was really only used by a few people. But it wasn't theirs, it was ours, and that was what the sentiment was. They turned it to rubble, brazenly, in the middle of the day, riding roughshod over the rules that are supposed to prevent things like that. Because what's a bit of tut-tutting and a tiny fine for a developer doing God's work, building things in a city, like so many others that measures its vitality by the number of cranes in the sky? And a developer who stands to make tens of millions by building on an empty city block and very little as a custodian of Melbourne's cultural heritage. But you could make an argument that the depth of anger, which, as I say, was deep and fierce, was overblown. This was one building in a part of Melbourne that most people would never even go, and a part of Melbourne already almost exclusively shaped by the whims of the biggest landholder and developer in Carlton, which is the University of Melbourne. The case becomes even stronger when you dig into what rules exactly the developers trashed. Much as the state government at the time jumped up and down about the vandals destroying our heritage, the Corkman was never going to be saved. Despite being the oldest building in Carlton, the site was at the time and remains today subject to a development overlay which allows for the construction of a 40-metre apartment tower. What the developers scotched by knocking the whole thing down was merely the requirement that the tower that they were and still are going to build start behind the facade of the existing building. The Corkman was always on borrowed time. But I'm going to say it wasn't an overreaction. It was very, it was a reasonable response because what the whole affair was just a moment that really brought to the surface the grinding reality that we know because we live it. The reality that the shape of our cities, these very human creations, feels largely outside of our control. And it gave a face to what's usually just this intangible sense that the city is the way it is because of perhaps this seemingly natural operation of unknowable and unalterable forces. For a bit, as Melbourne seethed, the Corkman gave those forces a name and a face and made very clear that our cities are shaped by people who make decisions at every step to maximise profit in a system that lives and breathes that pursuit. Of course, the city is not a predetermined fact or a natural phenomenon or shaped by forces that we can't know, and it's not only the outlandish antics of developers that shows us this. The rich history of struggle over the form and fabric of the city also punctures this facade. Cities are sites of struggle, certainly, because obviously cities are where capital and the working class is concentrated. Any movement worth its salt wants to make its claim in the city, and any government that wants to sort of prevent or impede struggle would seek to block access to the city. And, there's recent laws passed in New South Wales that seek to do that very thing. But in the battle over who gets to shape the daily quality of urban life, cities too have been the object of that struggle. The best and most well-known example, of course, is the Green Bands, in which construction workers organised in the BLF under the leadership of communist Jack Mundey in New South Wales and Norm Gallagher in Victoria, refused to demolish things that they thought should be protected and build things that they thought didn't need building. They were concerned to preserve heritage buildings, green space, public housing, and really just block all-round shit ideas like, according to Liz Ross, who's written one of the definitive histories of the BLF in Victoria, a car park and 24-hour restaurant in the Botanical Gardens. Who knew? Good job. That didn't happen. The New South Wales BLF was regarded as the most powerful town planning agency operating in New South Wales at the time it was active. The list of things saved by the union bands is too numerous to reel off, but it includes many buildings that still stand, others that we fight to retain, and others still where the battle has been lost. Most devastatingly, I think we'd say, would be the battle for Millers Point and the Rocks in Sydney. The ruling class of New South Wales has had this particular part of Sydney in its sights for some time, but a plan to clear out its working class population and redevelop the area which sits right up against the harbour was defeated by the BLF and residents in the 1970s, only to be carried through 40 years later, quite recently, by the New South Wales Liberal government. A government like governments throughout Australia that will no longer abide the travesty of prime harbourside housing in the case of Sydney, or in the case of Melbourne, creekside housing, which, you know, I think is quite nice. So in Victoria, the site of the sort of equivalent battle would be along the Mary Creek in Northcote. Governments no longer abiding by this type of housing being occupied by workers, new migrants and the poor. In New South Wales, the dispossession of the residents of Millers Point and the Sirius building nearby pocketed the New South Wales government the best part of $1 billion. Far from accepting the city and urban renewal, which only ever means out with the poor and in with the rich, far from accepting that such things are an unstoppable wave, the BLF built a movement on the very basis. The city does not simply appear before us. It is built and lived in by workers, and it's these people who should say what it looks like and how it works. They should lay claim to what Marxist geographer David Harvey describes as the right to make the city more after their heart's desire. Jack Mundey described it as an assertion that we are not just robots directed by developer builders. More and more we are going to determine which buildings we will build. The BLF understood the battle to improve the condition of the working class was as much a battle about the city as anything, saying there must be, in all this city area, provision for working class people, for people of lower middle income, to be able to reside in the area. It's not much good winning a 35-hour week if we're going to choke to death in planless and polluted cities where rents are too high, where ordinary people can't live. But it wasn't only the unions staking claim to the city. At the same time, as students and intellectuals began pouring into the inner cities during the 60s and 70s, drawn in by mass tertiary education and the political foment happening in the cities at the time, residents' action groups started springing up, and they too were intent on intervening in the city. It was a time of pitched battles over freeways, parks and slum clearances. So we started in Carlton, and in fact, the suburb of Carlton itself exists today as it does as a result of the fights at this time. So in 1969, the Housing Commission in Victoria was on a mission. It had plans to renew nearly 1 square kilometre of Carlton, and Carlton is in total size 2 square kilometres. So fully half of Carlton was in its sight. It declared these areas slums and ripe for renewal. And of course, when they said renewal, they mean what governments mean today when they say renewal, which is to demolish the housing and move out the residents. Many of the poor and working class residents of Carlton weren't interested in moving off, and they rejected the slum declaration and fought, on at least one occasion with shotgun in hand, to keep the commission out. You could get away with that sort of thing at the time. They were joined by the students and academics who weren't keen on the gritty and bohemian suburbs they'd been drawn to being turned over to the brutal modernism of the commission's prefab concrete housing and the towers that we all know today. It was in Carlton, in this defeat, that the Housing Commission's decades-long slum reclamation program came to an end. And today, as we'd all know, the slum houses are some of the most expensive in Melbourne. And the towers and concrete housing so reviled then, we defend today, now from ever-present threat. Okay, so that's a bit about struggle, which is certainly one of the forces that imposes itself on the city I just want to look a bit about what we have on the other side, which, as is often the case under capitalism, is an array of often competing capitalist interests. So you have the capitalists that build skyscrapers, which are totally different and opposed to the capitalists that build low-rise housing estates. Their interests are largely opposed and they're often battling with each other. You have the capitalists that build roads, you have other ones that toll the roads, you have capitalists that run the public transport, and there's obviously different intersections of interest there. You've got the businesses in the cities, the businesses in the suburbs. You've got the landowners and the people that run their business in the shopping centre. So it's a whole array of different interests that mean that urban development under capitalism is necessarily chaotic. It's also thoroughly irrational, considered against even the most basic measures of human need, to say nothing of the possibility that we might build our environment in such a way that elevates our dignity. Of course, nowhere is the sheer irrationality more evident than in considering how the interests that determine what happens in our cities have responded to the climate crisis. So think about this. Up and down the coasts of Australia, right now, houses, absolutely brand new houses, are still being built in areas that all sensible science says will be inundated by a rising sea by the end of this century. And well before that, vulnerable to huge storm surges. A group of researchers recently bravely asked a group of developers and property investors to anonymously explain how this could possibly be. Their answers were unsurprising but disturbingly candid. This is one champion. The change, and the change presumably being catastrophic sea level rises, isn't going to come through now or in the next 2, 3, 4, or 5 years. Long-term thinking. It's going to come through gradually over the next 50 to 100 years. And if that's the case, do I really need to care? I mean, it's a terribly selfish thing to say, so self-awareness. But as a property owner, do I need to care? If you look at Sydney, huge swathes of its urban growth area are on floodplains. And the current rule is it's just fine for developers to plant estates on those areas that are supposed to flood, the sort of mega floods, one in every 100 years. These are the very same areas that have had two such floods in the last 5 years. And the New South Wales government just scrapped a proposed, so not even introduced, but scrapped a proposed requirement that developers prepare hazard risk profiles for the new estates in areas that could be subject to flood and fires. And the developers pushed back hard, and it's been withdrawn on the basis that it undermined the economics of delivering housing. So in Melbourne, which is the fastest growing of all of Australia's cities, most of the growth is happening on the fringes, where about 100,000 people settle every year. The urban boundary has been expanded 3 times in the last 20 years, and 2 of those times were by a Labor government. And it's always at the behest of the developers and landowners who reap huge windfall profits when native grasslands and farmland is rezoned residential. And in most cases, it's as if the housing estates put there have been built as some sort of dark experiment, like a Black Mirror episode, about how could we design new housing estates so that we really just push this climate change thing up a notch. And at the same time, what if we made it that the people that we put in those estates feel the effects the worst and have the least ability to mitigate? So if you're going to carry out such a sick experiment, you would build a patchwork of disconnected planned communities well beyond the public transport network, with little in the way of jobs, shops, hospitals, or any community infrastructure at all. See, right now, if you live on the urban fringe, less than 5% of jobs are accessible to you within 60 minutes on public transport. And a similar proportion are accessible by 30 minutes if you have a car. So what it means is if you have a job, you will be driving, and you will be driving for a long time to get there. And because the estates are designed usually with only a couple of ways in or out, the congestion that you experience probably starts almost from the second you leave your driveway. You cannot do any of the things that you need to do to sustain yourself or your family without a car. And then there's the houses themselves. So prices for the houses are going up, but the blocks themselves are getting smaller, so the developers can carve out more from each land parcel. And if you look at a sort of heat map, you know, people who do infographic maps about what the city looks like, there's a sort of, you know, an inner ring of inner suburbs that are sort of smaller blocks, and it widens out into the sort of middle ring, but it shrinks right back in the urban growth areas. So, you know, much more closely aligned to the sort of inner, the Northcote-type suburbs, far, far out into the grasslands. But at the same time, the houses are getting bigger, which means that the house takes up most of the block, leaving not much room for a backyard. And the rates of imperviousness in some of these areas is as high as 90%. And imperviousness basically means a hard surface that, you know, water can't soak into. And hard surfaces on these housing estates are likely to be concrete, and they trap the heat and release it back out. increasing the temperature in these areas significantly by many degrees often, and it will only get worse over time. Canopy tree cover can help, but tiny backyards can't accommodate big trees, and the developers are not putting them in the streets, nor often are they building the parks that they promise in their ads. If you live on one of these estates, you will absolutely need an air conditioner just to be able to inhabit your house. But the exacerbation of the heat island effect caused by the imperviousness means that at times it will be too hot for your air conditioner to work. So who knew? It can actually get too hot for air conditioners to work, and it's not that far beyond the sort of temperatures that we will see regularly in the not too distant future. So over 48 degrees apparently, air conditioners will struggle to work. And in addition, because they're building the houses gutter to gutter, there's no room around the sides of them for the air circulation that air conditioners need. It sounds a bit like a sort of strange lesson in weird things you sort of didn't want to know, but this is actually, to the extent there's any growth in Melbourne, this is what it looks like, and this is what we're setting the world and people up for. So heat kills more people in Australia than any natural disaster, and actually most heat-related deaths happen in Victoria.
Wow, unbelievable. We'll hear the rest of Steph Price's Unlivable Cities. She gave this speech at the Marxist Conference. Fantastic stuff. If you want to get the rest of the Marxist Conference, they put them up on all the sessions up on podcasts. So, but this is particularly fantastic.
Okay, so the title of this talk is Unlivable Cities, and I presume that this is a riffing off of one of the catch cries of urban real estate speak, livability, which is a deliberately benign way of openly acknowledging that it's better to live in some parts of the city than others. In other words, the benefits and costs of urban environments are unequally shared. So I've touched on it a bit, but I want to look in a little bit more detail and a few more examples about what exactly it means and what it looks like to be low on the livability index. I don't think you can fall off the livability index, though life and death is a binary. The index doesn't recognise it. You can be right down the bottom, still going. Okay, so the closer you live to a pokies venue, the more likely you are to gamble, to lose and to experience all the ill effects associated with gambling addiction, which includes a hugely increased risk of suicide. If you live within 1 kilometre of the supermarket, you will likely be in better health and experience less disease than people who live further than 1 kilometre from the supermarket. And this association is strongest in working class areas. Access and proximity to green open space is associated with better social connections with those around you, better sleep, improved physical and mental health, and again, a reduction in disease. Even the presence or absence of street trees in your neighbourhood has an impact on the material conditions of your life. People are more likely to walk when there are trees, and they're more likely to talk to their neighbours. How does this play out in Melbourne? There are four times as many pokie venues in the outer north of Melbourne as there are in the inner east, say Boroondara for instance. In the urban growth areas, only 1/4 of houses are within 1 kilometre of a supermarket, and the 1 kilometre matters because they know that 1 kilometre is essentially, it's the maximum that most people will walk to access things. And so if you're not within 1 kilometre of a supermarket, again, the only way you get there is via a car. Green space. As one Google reviewer astutely commented when reviewing a park in Hawthorne, and the first comment was, rich people get better parks. While the distribution of parks and other open spaces is mixed, so some wealthy inner suburbs have comparatively few parks per person, but they have distinctly better tree canopy coverage. The evidence shows that parks in working class suburbs in Melbourne are much less likely to have the things that make parks nice and encourage the actual use as parks, so trees, paths, benches, shade and water. The tree canopy data shows that the parks in the western suburbs have less canopy tree coverage, and so canopy trees are obviously the big trees that create shade, less canopy tree coverage at 6.2% in the parks in the western suburbs than the industrial areas of the eastern suburbs, which sit at 7.7%. So this means that you're much more likely to find yourself sitting under the shade of an old gum tree if you're standing outside a factory in Malvern, for instance. There's no factories in Melbourne, but there's obviously industry in the east, than you are if you're standing in a park in sunshine. So I want to talk a bit about public infrastructure and in particular libraries, just as an example. So access to public libraries in Stonington, which takes in Malvern, Toorak and Prahran, there's one library for every 40,000 people. In Melton, which is in the outer west, and Dandenong, which is in the outer southeast, there's currently one library for every 90,000 people. In about 10 years' time, with Melton part of the urban growth corridor and expanding rapidly, the figure will be one library for every 160,000 people, By this time, there will be four times as many children living in Melton as there are in Stonington and half the number of libraries. But fear not. If you live in one of Melton's urban growth zones, chances are the only library-like thing anywhere near you is a library access point. An access point, if you didn't know, is a vending machine run by Lendlease. It's a bad replica of the most basic function of a library. You can collect your pre-ordered books from the machine without ever talking to a single person, let alone making a social connection. There's no building, of course, so no public space. Libraries obviously being one of the few remaining spaces that you can go and stay without being asked to buy anything. There are no shelves to browse. There's zero prospect of serendipitous discovery, which librarians will know is amazing. You have to marvel at their capacity to strip a library of everything that might possibly make a visit to one a meaningful experience. So you contrast the Lendlease book vending machines to the approach favoured for a little while by a reforming mayor in Bogota, Colombia, who built grand and beautiful buildings in some of the poorest areas of the city, where the possibility of building a library was more than a utilitarian exercise in distributing reading material. And so he said, there was an emphasis on not only that libraries were functional, but also that they had to be majestic, in homage to every child and every citizen who would enter there. It's unlikely that any child feels lifted by the majesty of the Lendlease vending machine. And of course, nothing about the way our cities works should lead us to believe that there is any intention at all for a working-class child to feel uplifted or inspired by their built environment. It's why children of the rich attend schools whose buildings are imposing and monumental and sit on acres of manicured playing fields while others learn in tin portables that crowd out the school oval. It's why developers are reaching new heights to cater for the ultra-wealthy with what are called super prime. There's a new thing, super prime luxury apartments. So it's beyond sort of ordinary luxury, including one in London which has a rooftop beach. While for the rest of us, it was the great reform of 2017. Yes, not 1917. It was the great reform of 2017 when the Victorian government decreed that all habitable rooms must have a window, in fact, to be habitable. Because apparently that wasn't clear to developers who were building apartments hand over fist with windowless bedrooms, apparently one in two before the rule changed. It's why the New South Wales Community Services Minister described the final clearing of Millers Point and the Rocks as fair. Because what's unfair? So unfair is not playing by the rules of the game. And what are the rules of the game? They are that property must be put to its highest value and that beautiful things that we have created are not really for us to enjoy. After all, like the sound of a tree falling in a forest where nobody can hear it, if it is a public tenant looking upon the harbour bridge from their flat and not someone who has paid the fair value of that view, can we even say the bridge was seen at all? To sum up, so there are challenges that humanity faces which we don't have easy answers to, even under a system controlled by the majority. But how to make cities that are fit for the people who live in them and the people that sustain them is not one of those challenges. Capitalism is the impediment to the making and remaking of cities in a way that provides comfort and beauty to all in equal measure. It's astounding how much is known about how our buildings, cities, parks and nature can improve or diminish our lives. In the very first strategic plan prepared for the City of Melbourne in 1929, so nearly 100 years ago, the authors knew that children needed parks to be healthy. They knew what was the minimum park space that each child in any given neighbourhood would need, and they knew what was the maximum distance that a child would be able to walk to get there 100 years ago. You could spend many years reading nothing else but the minutiae of how cities should work. It's known, for instance, what the ideal depth of a front garden is to encourage conviviality amongst neighbours but allow, you know, retreat for your senses. It's known what the ideal footpath width is to encourage walking. You know, how many curves are reasonable before a walker aborts. Look at the diagrams. The how they build the footpaths in the estates is unfriendly to walkers, and there's too many curves. And there's people who know about this. There's people who know about all of this. They know what type of street signage could help people with dementia navigate their neighbourhoods, and it goes on and on and on. But we will not win livable cities through better planning or latching onto new ideas that some people carve out within the system. And, you know, I think about in my work, we're, you know, always hearing about this sort of like wild new ideas that people come up with to address the housing crisis. And, you know, examples are, why don't we put people in micro shipping containers and stuff them on, you know. When in fact, we figured out a long time ago that shelter is best provided by houses. So why don't we build houses? We will win livable cities, cities that are fit for us, when we take on capitalism and when we win back the world. We need to fight for reforms, yes, but a truly beautiful city is one teeming with workers moving together in the fight for bigger change than that.